Welcome to Northwest Prime, bringing Seattle to the world and the world to Seattle. Follow us on Twitter at iGuestInfo. Send us your questions and we'll try to answer. Now enjoy the show.
All right. Well, thanks for tuning back in to Northwest Prime. We're bringing you nice people and great stories from the Northwest and around the world because, quite frankly, mean people suck. I have some unfinished business. We interviewed Alan White with Yes recently, and you can go back and listen to that if you missed it. Yes will be performing in Seattle March 3rd at the Moore Theater. Some people had some questions on that. And you can also go to yesworld.com. They will be performing around the country. They have about 30 dates. Heart will be performing April 9th, an acoustic concert at Benaroya Hall in Seattle, celebrating their induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We had Roger Fisher on, a member of Heart, and he will be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in April. And you can go to heartmusic.com or rogerfisher.com for more information on that. Today our guest is Matt Wilson, and Matt Wilson founded a company called Privateer Press, and they are a gaming company based in Seattle. Matt has since moved to Los Angeles to pursue taking his gaming company into film and television and other aspects of that. So we're going to find out. I am not a gamer. I don't know much about gaming, and so I want Matt to explain that to us in layman's terms for those of us who aren't gamers. But Matt has a lot going on. He's another brilliant illustrator, software maker, and he is going to take us through the workings of Privateer Press. So I'm going to be back with you in just a moment with Matt Wilson, and until then you can listen to the Seattle song by Science Seattle, Jim and Justin. Jim and Justin, proving that you do not have to work for Amazon or Microsoft or Boeing and be able to make a living in Seattle. And our next guest, Matt Wilson, is proof of that because he lived in Seattle. He has a company over in Bellevue called Privateer Press, and so he's been able to make a living without working for one of those Seattle major companies that everybody usually talks about. Hi, Matt. Thanks for coming on.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me.
No problem. So take me back, Matt. You founded Privateer Press. It kind of went from a basement startup company to now one of the largest independent producers of miniature games in the entire world, and now you've even relocated to the Los Angeles area to take Privateer Press even further globally. As a child, were you thinking about movies and thinking about games, and where was your mind when you were young?
Well, as a kid, pretty much my mind was always in movies or comics or games and toys. I'm definitely a child of Star Wars, like a lot of people of my generation. Seeing that film at 5 years old sort of set me on a trajectory of wanting to keep my head in this in this fantastic space of creativity and imagination. And so that was always what I did as a kid. And I drew a lot. I was that kid in class that would sit there and draw the monsters and the robots while everybody else was listening to the teacher. And I think, you know, one thing led to another. And for a while, you know, I really wanted to be an astronaut, but eventually I kind of came back to this place where I could just be creative all the time. So so when I got out of school, that's what I did. I immediately started trying to find a way to engage in that stuff. I don't have any formal training. I dropped out of college after my first year because there you really had to pay attention, and it wasn't working for me. So I started a comic book company. I was living down in Southern California at the time, and in the 90s there was a big wave with this resurgence of comic books, and it only lasted a few years, and I'd say I got into it too late, but that was sort of my first foray into both business, managing my own business, working for myself, as well as getting to work on my artwork and writing and all the things that sort of go into the production of something like a comic book. When that didn't work, I found gaming, which was always a hobby and a pastime of mine growing up, and I hadn't really considered it as a career choice, but I was lucky enough to fall in with a little company down in Southern California and help them get their first big game out, and sort of one thing led to another.
So gaming, is that like video games? Is that what it used to be?
No, actually, it's kind of what it's become. So there's a game that everybody's heard of called Dungeons and Dragons, and
right.
I think it came out back in the early 70s or something like that. It's had a very sorted history up and down, depending on the era they were in. And so that was something that I did as a teenager, and it spawned an entire industry, but it's a very small industry, a niche industry that a lot of people aren't even aware of. I think that more and more today people are aware of them as our geek culture has sort of grown and become very popular. But still, I think that the idea of tabletop gaming is something that is foreign to a lot of people. Basically, it consists of everything from card games to board games to role-playing games, the miniatures games that we do, I think what characterizes what we call adventure gaming is that it's more than just moving pieces around on a board like Monopoly or Sorry or Checkers or something like that. There's some sort mm-hmm. of fantasy or fiction going on with it, where you're engaging in this world, and that's what video games do today, but video games have sort of, you know, they have the advantage of the technology to immerse you into the game experience in a way that tabletop games aren't able to, because they don't have the technology. So the tabletop games sort of require you to have a very active imagination, you know, allow you to access that imagination so that you can engage in whatever the activity is that the game requires. So mostly they're played with physical components like dice, cards, these old-fashioned pen and paper to you know, to record things and keep track of things. And then with us, the miniatures games, you know, we make basically toy soldiers. We make millions of little robots and knights and warriors and monsters, and people amass and customize these large armies, and they play out these fantastic battles on tabletops that look like elaborate model railroad sort of terrain towns and things like that. And visually, they're very exciting to see. It's very imaginative. People that play them are also not just playing the games, but they're also very engaged in the hobby of it. So there's a lot of creativity and artistry that goes into the customization of these things. That they paint the figure, model them, and sort of, you know, customize them to their own. So it becomes a creative outlet as well as entertainment, a social activity, a way to engage a lot of people. And our community is hundreds of thousands strong all over the world. We sell our products only through independent hobby and game retailers. So you won't find us in Walmart or Target or any of those sort of mass marketplaces. But we're sold in every country that has a game store. So,
okay. Well, I kind of get that because I remember seeing my brothers play with the little green army men, and they mm-hmm. would really get lost in that, and they could play for hours like that, and their friends would come over and do that. But what this does, it kind of, and then later I saw them play Risk, and they could play that forever. But what you've done and what the gaming industry done has kind of taken that up many notches, and so now it's not little plastic army men, it's nice, you know, sculpted pieces, yeah. I guess, that people can buy. And so it's kind of that same kind of Risk mentality and the army men thing and strategy and, like you said, fantasy strategy. So there's kind of a lot going on. Can you play that? Do you have to play it together physically, or can it be done virtually or online?
It can be. I think that part of the attraction to the tabletop miniatures games, you know, and these games are, what you said is very accurate. It's kind of like combining the Little Green Army Men with Risk. What the games do is provide a common sort of set of rules to reenact those fantasies that you did, you know, as a child without the rules. You know, you ad-lib those and you improv them. And now what we've done is we've created, you know, a structure that everybody can engage in and sort of be able to play out these experiences. But part of the attraction to them is, I think, that kinetic experience of being able to have that miniature and move it. The miniatures are, you know, I have my fair share of Green Army, God knows. But the stuff that we make today is incredibly detailed and artistic, and we spend a huge amount of effort to try and make these things as incredible as they possibly can be, even though, you know, the average height of a human on the tabletop is about 1 inch. So they're not large, but some of the pieces get large. We've got giant robots and monsters and all kinds of fantastical things. And so I think that's part of why people love these games, is they get to possess that toy, that artifact, that model. And a lot of times they put hundreds of hours into building or painting. But it definitely can be played virtually, and there are online resources that allow you to actually play the games out using the same rules that the tabletop and, you know, virtual pieces. And so people are able to stay engaged with each other and play these games, you know, across the country if they want to. But we also, part of our business is that we facilitate what we call organized play. And so we have a global program, and we have about, I think, 700 volunteers in our network that go to the game stores and they demonstrate the games to people. And then they set up weekly league and tournaments that bring anywhere from a couple dozen to, in some cases, they turn to big conventions with, you know, 400 or 500 people that come and play for a weekend and play these games together. And so people travel all over the country and the world to be in the same place with each other. And,
right.
So that's still an important part of this community, is the face-to-face interaction. You know, the video games have sort of they don't have the need for that anymore, because you can be anywhere, anytime, you get online to play with somebody. You don't have to know who you're playing against necessarily, but it's also a great way to keep in touch with your friends. But I think that the community that has sort of grown up around these tabletop games is unique and really close in that regard.
Well, I've seen these pieces, and they're incredibly artistic, and I would think collectible, because they look like little pieces of art. And my first instinct when I saw them was that those could probably be worth some money, because they're just like you were saying, you've taken that little green, you know, army guy, and this is literally a piece of art. It's so detailed, and it's so just it's so intricate and so. It looks like a miniature sculpture of pieces. So it looks exactly like how, you know, the little green army men all kind of look the same. But they're all so completely different, and they all have their own little characteristics and personalities. And I can see that even if you didn't play the game, you should collect the pieces, because they're like little pieces of art everywhere.
Yeah, they absolutely are.
Yeah. And you helped design those, or design most of them.
Yeah, for a long time I was our primary concept artist, and so I would design the characters and the monsters and anything that was going into the game. Now I do much less of that. I actually rarely am doing any artwork myself, but I work with everybody in a creative capacity. My role at Privateer is the chief creative officer, so I sort of touch everything that we do in some capacity, and usually to try and kind of direct it visually or in the writing or the marketing that we do. I sort of have my hands in all of that. But the most fun part is really the designing of those characters, because we get to sit around as a group and we talk about the next character, monster, thing that we want to realize in the environment. And it's a great creative process. We're bouncing ideas off of each other. There's a lot of mental gymnastics that you go through to try and make things work in terms of both story and game, because the game have game mechanics, right? There's rules and there's structure to them, and they have to stay consistent so that people can understand them and play them. And we're trying to express those rules that are essentially, you know, mathematic equations into something that feels like an experience for the player that resembles, being able to duel with another character, or being able to use a superpower or a magical ability, and, you know, so that when they roll the dice, they feel like they're actually, you know, part of that world. But the process that we go through to create these things is really incredible, and they, while the miniatures themselves, as we sell them, they're not specifically collectible. By the time they get finished by the player, by the hobbyist who actually paints them, they are unique and one of a kind. And they've involved the skills and the talent and the vision of so many artists along the way, whether it was the concept artist who did the original drawing, or the sculptor who then interprets that into the 3D expression that was going to get molded, manufactured at our facility, And then eventually the hobbyist has their opportunity to assemble it, customize it if they want. A lot of people will change the model to make it even more unique and more to their vision. And then ultimately they get painted. And there's some just incredible painters out there that once they get their hands on the miniature and are able to sort of put their talent to it, they bring it to life. And that's sort of the final expression. In a lot of cases, these things go from being a $10 miniature off the shelf to something people will pay $500 or $600 for because they're successful.
Wow, that is amazing. That is amazing. Now, you said there's math involved. You lost me there. So,
how much math? Best subject
Just counting the dice math or actually the fractions? Because well, I won't be able to play if there's fractions involved.
Right. We try and keep the game, we say simple, although I think, they're pretty complex. When you have to read 60 or 100 pages of rules to understand the game, right? It's a lot different than, like, when you used to open up a board game and the rules are printed on the inside of the box, right? And you're like, oh, I got to read all these. And so that's part of it. And understanding, it, like, being able to parse and process all those rules, I gotta say, it's sort of beyond me. I design the games, but I'm lousy at playing them because I just I don't think fast enough to be tactical in that kind of competitive situation. But I love the process of actually working out the creative ways to do things that aren't terribly complex with dice and rely on to make these games fair and balanced. So for the player, most of the math is, rolling dice and adding up three or four dice at the most and then kind of comparing that result against something else and, whatever's highest. But sometimes you might have to do a little subtraction. But we don't get into the fractions or anything.
Okay. Well, but if it gets more complicated than that, they would kill me and take all my pieces, probably.
That's generally what happens to me. So.
Well, how did Privateer Press wind up in Bellevue? And that's where it is today, right?
That's where we've been. I think we're going on 7 years there, 7 or 8 years now, I think. We started in a little basement in northern Seattle. And it was the whole company was really started on a lark. There was never this intention to create something that's going to last for a long time, or much less have 100 people working in one place. It was three guys who each pitched in $2,000 to print a book, and we printed a book, and one thing led to another. And it was never overnight success. It was never it was never easy. Things were always just good enough to keep us engaged and working at it and trying to sort of build to the next level. So when we first started, we were outsourcing all of our production, which we would get the miniatures sculpted, and then we'd send them to some place to have them manufactured. They'd send us back boxes of metal that we would then hand pack into the packaging. The way these things are sold is we call them blister packs, so like a little plastic carton that hangs on the rack, and it'll have a miniature in it. And we would hand pack each of these things, and then we'd ship them out to our distributors. And our flagship game, which is called War Machine, it did get traction very quickly in the game community and start to grow rapidly. And it quickly outpaced the ability of the people that we were outsourcing to manufacture as quickly as a game. So we had to create our own factory and our own facility a lot sooner than we had sort of expected that we would ever need to. The first place that we did that was a warehouse just down on Market Street in Ballard. So there we were in this big old freezing cold warehouse because it had no heating. It was one of these big metals. It's an old aluminum extrusion facility, I think. And it didn't even have a restroom. guys would be there, and there was a coffee shop across the street who was actually the landlord of the warehouse that he was gracious enough to let our guys go back and forth and use the facilities that they needed to. And then eventually, a couple moves later and a couple years later, we, after moving up the street on Market Street, then we made the jump over to Bellevue. And the reason for that was there wasn't any sort of specific design of where we needed to go, other than we had outgrown the space that we were in. Everybody's offices and the hallways were being used for storage. You couldn't move in this place, and it was sort of restricting our ability to grow the company and fulfill the demand for the products. So we needed more space, and we looked around for months and months to find a place that gave us the split that we needed between sort of office and manufacturing space. And usually it kind of goes one way or the other, where there are a lot of offices and a little bit of storage, or a lot of manufacturing space and only a little bit of offices. But the privateer is sort of unique, and then we're almost split down the middle between the creative, like pre-press side of the company, doing the artwork and the layouts for books and editing and writing and all those things, and then the manufacturing side. So right now we've got about 100 people there, and about half and half. The other half of the company is involved in the manufacturing, and the molds and miniatures, and they produce them right there on site, and it's an actual factory, and then they ship right out of our warehouse there. So
wow.
So we settled there. Yeah, it's we do manufacture overseas as well, but I think that the majority of our manufacturing right now is right there in Bellevue.
Wow, you know, all roads in Seattle lead to Bellevue for some reason. Everything is going on in Bellevue now. It used to be, there used to be a lot going on in Ballard, but now it seems like everybody's in Bellevue.
It's a great
place.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how many people are employed at Privateer Press right now, did you say? About?
I think it's around 100, and we're constantly we're continually hiring more, pretty much as fast as we can for the various roles that we have to fulfill. We also have a partner factory in Liverpool that is doing the services, and they do all the manufacturing and distribution for the EU, and mm-hmm. and then as well we probably work with a couple hundred other. External contractors, artists, writers, sculptors, editors around the world that contribute to our products in various ways. Because we have actually, in addition to the miniatures, we do a lot of book production. We have a magazine that comes out every 2 months regularly. That's now been going on for like ten years. And we do these board games and card games and a variety of different products. So there's just a huge number of people involved in the production.
Wow, yeah, that's amazing. Okay, so that kind of gives everybody a pretty good idea of what you're doing and what's going on over there in Bellevue and the gaming part and how we got there. But then you left Seattle and you moved to Beverly. No, you moved to Los Angeles because you wanted to take Privateer Press and this gaming and your own visions into movie making and other types of film production. So why don't you tell us about that now? Because that is a whole nother dimension to this.
Yeah, it's sort of the crazy leap of faith with the whole thing too. They mentioned the games are all expressions of really large worlds. So we do one of the sort of precepts of the products that we make is that they're all very story oriented, and we tell these elaborate epic stories through the games And we sort of realized every corner of the world. So in the case of War Machine, which is set in this this fantasy world called the Iron Kingdoms, we've published over two dozen books and probably 5,000 or 6,000 pages of material about this world. And, you know, in an effort to be able to answer just about anything that you could imagine to ask. And so because we've got this great development behind us for this game, we have the opportunity to take it into other mediums. And I work with a video game company down here in Los Angeles right now where we're trying to find a way to make a War Machine video game. And I've got some producers that I've been working with to try and turn another one of our game lines called Level 7 into a feature film. And we're constantly exploring opportunities in television and animation and film to see if there's some place that we can, you know, take these different properties and realize them in larger mediums and bring them to a wider audience. And in fact, a few years ago, we sold another game called Monster Apocalypse to DreamWorks. We had Tim Burton attached to actually direct the film for a while. It has slowed down now because that's kind of the way Hollywood looks, but it was an exciting time, and it got us going with a lot of other projects as well. So then I found myself commuting back and forth for a couple of years where every other week, every 2 weeks, I was down here for several days, you know, in California, Los Angeles, for a series of meetings. It was getting exhausting. And it was also something that I personally really wanted to do. Filmmaking has always been my first passion. And even though I lived in Southern California, when I finished high school, I just had no idea, like, what steps to take to get into the film industry. So I had to move to Seattle for 14 years to get that figured out. And now I'm back down here pursuing my own personal projects in screenwriting and directing, as well as trying to take these properties of Privateer and move them into other mediums. And in some cases, that effort is actually combined. In the case of the Level 7 that I mentioned, that's actually something that I've tried to get sold to be my first feature to direct. So it's not something that I would.
Nice.
It's exciting. It's a crazy place.
How have you found the reception in Hollywood to be? Is it easy to navigate? Is it hard to navigate? Is it what you thought it would be? Is it better or worse?
My opinion and attitude on it probably changes daily, if not more often. I think that it's sort of everything that you could expect. And, the good and the bad. And there's a lot of wonderful people that I have met down here, and everybody is always great the first time you meet them. Where things go is a different story. And that's probably, for myself, has been the most difficult adjustment to sort of trying to work in another industry where, for the last 12 years with Privateer Press, I've charted my own course, right? And it was a collaborative effort with all the other people that are part of that company. But when we put our minds together and decided that we want to do something, we want to make a new product or try something new, then we just do it. The only thing that holds us back is whether or not we have the capital or the time to be able to make that happen. And it's a very quick decision. We're a very agile company. We can be responsive to our audience, to the marketplace, to changing times, to trends, we always say we're the only people that we're beholden to are our actual customers, right? They're the ones that are going to decide what we do next, and it gives us a lot of freedom and flexibility to what we want. But down here in the Hollywood system, it's very much a system, and there's very much a process and a series of gates that you have to you have to open up one after the other in order to make these opportunities happen. And for me, I have found it to be a very slow process.
Right.
When somebody says, "I'll get right back to you," that can mean weeks or months because everybody out here is working on a dozen different projects. And whichever one is sort of moving at the time is the one that gets their attention. And, you know, if you're if you're a creator, a writer, a director, you have projects that you want to make, you know, what you're trying to do all the time is just position yourself to be that project that gets the attention from somebody that can actually move it to the next level. And, it's exciting at times and it's frustrating at other times. And so what I found is in order to get along with that, for a while I was just trying to like get this one thing done, putting all of my effort into it. So now what I've done is I've got 12 projects that are all in various forms of development, and depending on what's getting attention and traction, that's the one that I put my attention to, and try to push that one forward a little bit. And then I've found that there's also other ways to get films done. And so while I've got two films that we need to get financing for in order to produce, and these are projects that are constantly taking meetings on and meeting with people, working with some effects companies to do pre-visualization for them. We've got producers that we're working with that are trying to finance them. Meanwhile, in order to start spacing, I've got my own project that I'm working on that I can do for nothing independently and try and achieve them outside of the system so that I don't kind of constantly run into those walls that seem to be up all of the things.
Well, Hollywood is kind of like a game too then, because you have all these little kind of worlds going on and you have to position yourself to move yourself forward. It's almost like what you're doing, except, in real life, real time, so to speak. But it's that same strategic concept going on in the brain.
Yeah, very, very much so. And I think I probably realized the game a little later than I should have. But yeah, you have to learn a whole new set of rules to be able to sort of play in this environment. And I'd say where I'm used to sort of designing games that are going to be an enjoyable experience, whether or not you win or lose, Hollywood is not so kind in the way that they designed this game. And so it's not really balanced in your favor.
There's so much that's out of your control. When you're at Privateer Quest and you're designing these things and you're the founder and the, creative force behind it, things move. You're making those things happen. You're in control, and you can move those things forward at your pace, whereas now a lot of that control's out of your hands. You still have the creativeness going on, but you're limited in how fast you can move that game forward because there's more components in. We've talked a lot about Hollywood on this show and how the wheels of Hollywood move very slow. We tried to get that across to people only because we have a large 50 Shades of Grey following. And, 50 Shades of Grey takes place in Seattle, so there's a big demand for all things Seattle. But there's also a big push from the fans. They want a movie. They want it yesterday. They want all three movies yesterday. We've tried to get that word out. We've had a lot of people involved in the book on the show and tried to calm the fans down about how slow the process actually works. And so you are a good one to come on and again reiterate that it's not us telling them that the wheels in Hollywood do move slow. That's just a reality, no matter what project you have.
Yeah, it certainly is. And I'm constantly being reminded by my betters and the people who have experience in this world that a lot of, the most famous films and projects took years and years to get made. And I think, the story with like The Matrix, right, which was, a watershed film. And it took the Wachowskis, I think, 10 years to actually get that made. And that's a long time to devote yourself to one project and, the passion that you have for that to weather all of the no's that you get along the way or the resistance or, I think the even worse than the no's are the false starts, right? When and all of a sudden something starts and it looks like it's going to go and you've got cast attached to this and you've got people who are committed to to putting money into it. And you're thinking, man, this thing's going to come together. And there's this really, you know, there's nothing more exciting than when you see a little bit of momentum on the project. And then all of a sudden something happens, right? Somebody pulls out of the project for some reason, or for some reason they just pull it, it's dismantled, or you find out there's a competing project that is going to mean that nobody wants to touch yours now. And that's like, those things happen all the time because it's such a mill here. It's such an industry where so much is getting done. And you never know what's going to come up and what's going to, you know, maybe pull the rug out from under what you're doing. So I really believe that every movie that gets made, no matter how good or how bad it is, the fact that it actually got completed to a point where somebody could sit down and watch the whole film is a minor miracle, because it takes so much effort from so many different people to actually, you know, realize the vision and get it through all these various stages of production to the point that it actually finishes, you know, crosses the finish line. And it just is...
Right.
Having been involved in a couple of short films myself, which were only a few minutes long, and just seeing the effort and experience in that to get those done has shown me that you know, to try and make something that's actually 2 hours long and have hundreds of special effects in it and this cast of hundreds, I marvel at those and the fact that they can be made at all.
Well, I heard Steven Spielberg say recently it took him years to get Lincoln made. And now, of course, Lincoln's up for all kinds of Academy Awards. And you would think Steven Spielberg, you would think he could just snap his fingers and have any movie made he wanted. And yet here he is fighting for Lincoln, which ended up, of course, you know, his instincts were right. Lincoln is a masterpiece. But it took him, you know, he had to really, you know, work to get Lincoln to the theater.
Absolutely. And I think it doesn't matter what level of success you've had. I think your next project is always, you know, a challenge. But I think also directors, you know, people like Steven Spielberg, they also look for that, right? When you're somebody like Spielberg, who's a genius filmmaker and has done so much, and what's he going to do next, right? Like, he's not going to pick the easy road. He's going to pick that thing that's going to
challenge.
It's really going to push him to a new level. And I think that's what he did with Lincoln, where he, and why it would take so many years is because to realize the vision that he wanted to create, it's going to be something that he hadn't ever done before, and that nobody had done before. So
what's your prediction for the Oscar, Matt? Do you think it's going to go to Lincoln, or you think Ben's going to pull it out with Argo?
That's a tough one. And I have to say, I have to confess, I have not actually seen either of them. I have watched from the sidelines, and I'm dying to see both of them. But I became a father a couple years ago, and so I see everything 6 months after everybody else. So I'm dying for both of those to hit DVD, and I'm following the media with rapt anticipation to see which one, because I'm deeply fascinated with both of those filmmakers and both of the stories behind them. But I could not get a prediction with any kind of expertise.
Well, I think it could go either way. You know, I have seen them, and of course they're both great films. Originally, I would have thought Lincoln, but you know, there's all of this warmth and warm fuzzies behind Ben because he didn't get nominated for directing, and so it might push Argo over. I don't know. It's going to be interesting to watch. So
everything
it's going to be interesting to see.
Everything I've heard is that they both deserve it. So I think
that's true.
Either way, you know, something deserving is going to get you.
Yeah, well, you know, the movie watching public really made out on those because they are both great films. So that's, you know, I'll be happy either way, and I will be watching.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and Matt, we're going to be watching for you. Thank you for coming on. We want to follow your career. Good luck in Hollywood. I mean, geez, we know somebody, people. We actually know Private Deer Press in Bellevue is our 6 degrees of separation to Matt in Hollywood. And we can follow, and now we all have a friend in Hollywood, and his name is Matt Wilson.
Thank you very much, Lori.
Well, thank you for coming on, and people can go to privateerpress.com for more information on the gaming, and if they want to more information on what you're doing, do you have a website, or is that all done through Privateer Press?
I do have my own blog, mattwilsonprime.com, and there I regularly update it with just whatever I happen to be working on, whether it's a new piece of concept artwork or my thoughts about writing or a film project that I'm working on. I like to ramble at length. So.
All right, that sounds good. So they can go to mattwilsonprime.com. They can go to Privateer Press to keep up on the gaming and what's going on with the miniatures and the games and War Machine and then mattwilsonprime.com for what Matt is doing in Hollywood. Thanks, Matt, for coming on. We really appreciate it. It was fun. I learned a lot. So that is amazing. We love to have nice people on the show, and we just wish you the best of success.
Thanks so much. Thanks for the opportunity to come on. It was a pleasure.
Okay. All right. Have a good day.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right, so that was Matt Wilson. He's the founder of Privateer Press, and you just caught up with him on what's going on with him in Hollywood. He had sold his Monster Opalypse to DreamWorks. Tim Burton was working on that, and again, the wheels in Hollywood run very slow, and so that's just in, I don't know, in production, I guess. So you will want to stay with us. We have some great shows coming up. Lee Oscar is going to be our guest tomorrow. He is he plays the harmonica better than anyone on the planet. I think you won't get any argument from people there. He was with the band, still is with the band War, one of the greatest rock bands of all times. Lee will be our guest tomorrow. Then coming up, we are going to have, in the next couple of weeks, Regina Brett. Regina Brett came to my attention. Hoda Kotb at the Today Show had read the book God Never Blinks and just raved about it. So I, of course, went out and got the book and read it, and it is a fantastic book, God Never Blinks. It's a New York Times bestseller. Regina Brett was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize on several occasions. She also has another book called Be the Miracle. Got a hold of Regina. She is going to be coming on the show on March 4th. And then Molly Finan, talk about people who create things in their basement. I need a basement. Good things happen in basements. I don't have a basement. That's probably why I'm on the radio, and these people are in People Magazine. But Matt Wilson, you heard him. He started Privateer Press in a basement. Now it's a worldwide phenomenon, going to movies and TV and film. And Molly Finan, in her basement, she created a product called Babyators, which are like the aviator sunglasses, but for children. And they're made of some type of plastic, and they're indestructible. Mariah Carey and Nick Cannon's kids are wearing them. Ellen DeGeneres has them on her nieces. Again, in People Magazine, Parents Magazine, everybody's raving about Babyators. Molly's going to come on and tell us about that product that's just skyrocketed, and about the indestructibility of these glasses for kids to protect their eyes from the sun, and the lifetime guarantee. And then later on in March, we're going to have Pastor Kevin Brown. He's the lead pastor at the Bellevue First Congregational Church, and he's going to talk to us about forgiveness. And so looking forward to him coming on. And we're going to go out today with The River and the Rain by Caitlin Logan. Caitlin Logan is a Seattle singer-songwriter. She has a wonderful voice, and she is on local radio here, and her dad can listen. Her dad has been in Afghanistan many times. I believe that he is there again right now, and so he taps into Seattle radio to hear his daughter sing, and so you will be able to hear her sing as well as we go out. You can hear more on local Seattle music and information 24/7 on myseattlenightout.com, and you can follow us on Seattle Wave Radio, where we are played daily. And let's go out today with Caitlin Logan, Seattle native, River in the Rain. Thanks for tuning in.
Can you hear?